All right, let's jump into the Seiyu segment. This is Seiyu segment number two here. I've got Rosewall L. Mavers, or as he pronounces it in the anime, he says like Meza. it looks like Mavers to me. He's voiced by Koyasu Takehito, and he's also the voice of Zex Marquis from Gundam Wing. I don't know if y'all remember him. He's the prettiest boy of a show already overflowing with pretty boys.
I do not remember him.
I remember him very well. He's also the voice of Kiryu Toga in Revolutionary Girl Utena, arguably also one of the prettiest boys in that show. And he's also the voice of Dio Brando in all of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure.
Oh, Dio, huh? It checks out.
This is many people's a daddy over here. And this guy, Koyasu Takehito, has made a career out of voicing lots and lots of hot boys. His resume is full of them. And usually, they're the kind of a broody, emotional, very, very deep, very sonorous voiced pretty boys, which in this series, voicing Rosewall is kind of a bit of a counter, an against type kind of play, right?
Mm. I can't remember Rosewall's voice. My assumption is that it's the classic voice that archetypical character has, long vowels and high pitched.
Yugi Boy.
yeah
or rather Pegasus.
Which you might recall in episode 4 when he's in that creepy scene where Ram is sitting on his lap. His voice sort of changes in character to more resemble the kind of characters that this voice actor usually voices. He sort of drops the affectation with the extended vowels and becomes altogether a bit more sinister. And of course, the kind of otaku that pays attention to this stuff, who knows all of these voice actors by name, they know, oh, this is that guy, so why is he voicing this character? And questions arise. All right, well, let's get into episode 5. The morning of our promise is still distant.
Yes.
Is what the episode is called. Subaru is overwhelmed as the twin maids gaze down at him in confusion. Everything has reset to his first day in the mansion. He leaps out of bed, runs down the hallway, and enters a door into Betty's library. He takes some time to catch his breath and reassess. His save point seems to have moved forward now, but he doesn't recall having died. After catching some more shade from Beatrice, Subaru seems to calm down a bit. He heads out with a new game plan.
This was interesting bit, yeah. Oh, go on, Vicky.
Yeah, I could be remembering this wrong, but I kind of got the feeling Beatrice kind of knew something was going on, or wasn't as oblivious to his situation as you might expect her to be, maybe.
It seemed weirdly hinting towards it. I think what I had took from it was that the initial scene where he's in that looping corridor in the previous episode and first meets Beatrice has still happened in this new loop. So it's the second time he wakes up rather than the first. But even within that, it still felt a bit weird. It felt there was something more there. And why is it? Why there? Because why is it the second time he's woken up rather than the first time? It doesn't quite fit. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like some save scumming has been going on here. He's hit F5.
He did have all his mana drained, which.
yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, that there is like a kind of a that mana draining event that happens before his new save point. Betty has like a couple of cryptic lines here, which kind of further set up the unknowableness of her character currently. When we first meet her, she says some stuff about not measuring her against like the standards of humans, and here she makes like a couple more cryptic overtures towards like her nature as a being and her relationship with time, like as Subaru is sort of muttering about his situation and like wondering how the fuck he got returned by death. She's like berating him for like his limited perspective on life and death, and that of all humans actually. Yeah, no, I like it when
interesting moment.
I like it when Betty does that type of shit. But I think the most interesting part of this scene is how Subaru is like really quick to recuperate in the midst of like Betty's verbal jabs. He sort of gets himself together and he says something like, seeing your attitude unchanged is like, has helped me recover, is what he says.
Did say that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like having a nice anchoring point to remind him that, like, even though this loop is happening and it's bad and it's weird and it sucks, there are some things that he knows and are familiar to him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's comforting.
Yeah. Which sort of begs the question, like, why is Subaru drawn to like dismissiveness and this verbal abuse as like as an anchoring point, right? even Beatrice says something to that effect. She's like, only an unparalleled degenerate would feel soothed by verbal abuse or something like that.
Well, we don't know anything about Subaru's mother.
that's where I would start looking as well. Yeah, about to find out that Subaru's mom has like ringlets too. We'll see.
That is the same.
His mom's a lolly.
Subaru runs into Emilia on the grounds. He does some more flirting and makes the same petting deal with Puck. In his mind, Subaru is determined to reclaim the smile he saw on Emilia's face on the evening before their promised date. We fast forward to the lunch scene where Subaru asks to be hired at the mansion again. And I think it's interesting to note Emilia in the last loop sort of like gave Subaru a bit of a hint. She was like, why ask to be hired when you can simply ask to be a guest at the mansion?
I was fully expecting him to switch. Yeah,
it seems like a good idea to Subaru for a moment, but like he makes the same choice here. Yeah, but that might be down to his philosophy about like how this return to death works.
Yeah, he thinks that like recreating or following the same steps, exactly the same steps that he did the last time, will get him to the same place, like getting a date with Emilia. So he's trying to do everything the same. But he also doesn't know why he's returned to death. Like, what happened? If I were him, I'd want to know, did I die? Like, why is time reset all of a sudden? So I would want to do something differently, but he doesn't.
Yeah, it's a terrifying position to be in, right? And, like, have your relationship to causality tested in such a grim way. Like, we're left in the dark throughout most of this episode about what led him to loop again. But the rules that have been established in the last four episodes seem to clearly state, if you die, you retry.
Exactly.
So, like, are they switching up the rules? Is there, like, a set number of days that you... Do you need to, like, advance the plot, so to speak? Like...
When I first saw it, I was feeling like it was like new rules and new additions of time period is different, like how far back they've gone is different. There wasn't like a death. It's like, it made me think there's like extra details in there or something. Mm-hmm. Or something to do with Amelia, especially with that the animation we spoke about in the like previous episode with all the like cherry blossom type stuff.
Yeah.
When I watched it, I definitely thought he'd died. I thought seeing it, but he's like something's happened to him in his sleep. He's been killed in his sleep, and I thought the reason that his save point is here is because I don't know, like he escaped death, I suppose, to advance the plot a little further in order to wake up in this mansion. But he lost consciousness between those two times, right? He lost consciousness and then woke up in this mansion, and that's where his new save point is, or something like that. But then it raises so many questions about where, if there is a timeline, you know, like where are these points where, like, are there points plotted where he is destined to die and he has to overcome those in order to like move forwards? And it kind of makes me think about Steins Gate a little bit. I can't remember what they called them in that, when the time branches off into other timelines.
Yeah, is it called like world line tendency or something?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, the world lines. Yeah. Think about that.
As long as you're in the alpha world line, Mayuri is going to die, and there's nothing you can do about it, unless you change things in a way so radical that you alter the course of destiny. Is the simplified version of that, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm. The adaptation's done by the same person? Is that right?
The adaptation's written by the same person that did the adaptation of Steins Gate, yeah.
Mm, cool.
Yeah, he seems to like this kind of story. Yeah.
This is just another world line. That's what we find out later.
Steins Gate Extended Universe, White Fox Extended Universe. Follow the same path and you end up in the same place, Subaru says to himself as he grabs his uniform from the walk-in closet. But things do appear different. The twins seem a bit colder to him and a bit more distant. They put him to work immediately without the extended getting-to-know-you phase of the previous loop.
I'm glad they did this. But there's also weird bits about it. But as a little sequence of going through the rapid time jumps to those few key decisions that Subaru makes, and showing the same ones, but oh no, it's not playing out the same way. And you know, he wants it to play out the same way, but that's not going to happen. It's as a viewer, it's nice to know that one, they are skipping over the bits that go the same, so you will see new stuff. And then, two, just having it, spelled out to you that it's going to be different. Yeah, the bit that raises it's a bit weird is that, why are the twins, more distant to him after, the previous loop that he woke up with them?
It could totally be, I was just going to say, because as hard as Subaru is trying to do things exactly the same, he can't do things exactly the same and hasn't already from the moment he's woken up. The way he behaved when different. He woke up was different. Yeah, it's already different. He can't fully recreate the previous loop. So it's kind of the way that every tiny decision you make has a massive impact on the trajectory of your life or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Ashton Kutcher, the butterfly effect, baby.
Exploding birdhouse.
Yeah, no, I was gonna say the same thing early. Subaru sets his mind to recreating the steps that led him to that date, more or less. But just the mere act of observing the something changes its nature, right?
Exactly. So, yes.
Yeah, so he can't reproduce. He gets off on the wrong foot to begin with, he can't reproduce that same first go around, that first reaction to what people say, and even when he calls Emilia-chan in this loop, it feels like, you know, this forced thing, I need to recreate this this vibe, Whereas in like the first time around, it was like Subaru being playful, being flirty,
being natural.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to tell this kind of story, because like I think about something like Groundhog's Day, where this loop happens on, it's sort of a clockwork fashion, like no matter mm-hmm. what, everyone around you will behave the same. It's like your intervention that changes things, but mm-hmm. like this feels more true to life in a sense that like people's attitudes shift and change in relationship to your actions, and that like a ripple effect happens. Yeah. Later that day, Subaru is having a soak in a lavish bath, wondering why things are so different. He is joined by Rosewall, despite his apparent discomfort.
The guy's butt naked.
Yeah, well, how else is he gonna have a bath, right?
Yeah, I know.
The bath looks fantastic as well. Like,
it's so big.
Huge, massive bathhouse. Like, just in the mansion. Mm.
Goals.
And they have a chat about the twins. To Subaru, Rem just seems like a shit version of Rem. But they remain very devoted to each other. So previously we've noticed a bit of a disparity between these two characters. But like I think that grows over the course of this episode as well. It's interesting to see. It's my favorite thing about this episode, I think.
You do definitely get to see it. You see it way more. It's like, it's still hard to tell them apart, but like they really try and show you the two different versions.
Yeah, that's it. They make an effort to establish the differences between the characters.
But all the while, like the one most defining trait is like how their inseparability and their like the devotion to each other. Ram surprises Subaru as he exits the bath. She has apparently arrived to help Rosewall into his two-toned black and yellow funk. At Subaru's snide comments, she also betrays a strong devotion to Rosewall. She tells Subaru she will be stopping by his room later that evening.
Is it Ram that was sat on Rosewall's knee in the previous episode?
Yeah. Mm. The pink-haired one.
Mm. Okay, got it. I'll try and remember that.
That's the one that's not very good at any tasks?
Yeah.
Cool.
Your specialty is steamed potatoes. And apparently helping Rosewall into his fong.
Yeah.
Hey, we all have that one thing we're really good at. two things in this case, I guess.
Subaru paces in his room, worried for some reason that Ram is plotting to steal his innocence or something. Very, very conceited attitude.
Yeah. Very presumptuous.
Fan service. Yeah. Very presumptuous, yeah.
He thinks about it, though. He considers it.
It's not just a straight, though.
he's got like some confidence for a supposed hikikomori, but like I guess that might change if you're like suddenly transported to the isekai fantasy of your dreams. Instead, she sneaks into his room in order to teach him how to read and write.
Quick backtrack, there is something weird still about like him being like, oh no, I don't want to like have my innocence stolen by Ram, I've got my heart set on Amelia. It's like that happens like super quick, I feel like, in terms of, while you can see them flirting, it's just like you, like he's got this like promised date, and it's suddenly like from that one date it's like all built up in his mind of like, cool, we're gonna get married, like
yeah,
which maybe isn't that like unrealistic, but it's like a newly formed character trait, I think, of like, well, like it's not quite, but it feels that he's like, he's expressing it more. Like, whereas in the past, it's like, oh, I don't want to see this person die, so I'm not gonna leave them. That feels like more like friendly than like, yeah.
But I think the thing that's changed is that in his mind, the previous night, Amelia agreed to go on a date with him. It's like solidified a little bit or become a little bit more real for him, I suppose. The possibility of romance.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does speak to like a level of presumptuousness that a Subaru has that he carries around, and this is just a out of left field read for me as well. But like perhaps he's looking at it in the same way one might look at a visual novel or like a dating simulator. He's completed the rescue the maiden events. He's completed the ask the maiden out events. So yeah, basically he's on the fast track to marriage, to happily ever after, whatever else. Yeah, that's just I feel like that's a sentiment that's reflected in like many anime protagonists. They're like their parents' misinformation or like a lack of knowledge about romance is like supplanted by knowledge of visual novels and dating sims.
Yeah.
And we know this guy has that knowledge because he's often tried to contextualize his own being here in relation to video games and isekai.
Yeah, it's almost as if this is the only way he can understand the world, and now all of those traits are being reinforced by the happenstance of being isekai'd. Ram sneaks into his room to teach him how to read and write. This way, she can send him shopping and get him to do more work, thus giving herself and her sister an easier time. Subaru complies happily, and not much later, Ram is fast asleep on his bed.
It's a weird trait to learn, this one. Like,
right?
I'm all for using like time loops to learn new skills, but learning to read and write is like, why doesn't he know that already?
Well, they kind of said in the first episode, right, that there's like a different language here.
Ah, cool. Is that right? I totally missed that in that case.
Yeah,
like, I thought he'd established that it was the same language.
He can't read, so like I think was it the fruit vendor,
yeah,
who had like maybe something written on his stand that Subaru couldn't read.
Yeah,
something like
was
that.
Was it a price? But like maybe it was more about the like text. Yeah,
yeah,
that would make a lot more sense.
Yeah,
yeah. So like Subaru's speech is auto translated. But he's unable to read the script of this world.
In my mind, it was just part of his like otaku nature. I was like, what video games?
He can't read or write.
Yeah. Like, how is he getting by as an otaku if he can't read and write? Just really good at Tetris.
It's a Tetris otaku. Yeah. You don't need to read to put together Gunpla. It's like it's all pictures. I think this is an interesting scene for getting to know Ram a little bit better, because she reveals a side of herself that we did not see in the first loop at all. Is that like Ram is just a little bit lazy. She wants to like offload this work on Subaru. Partially out of like a bit of self-interest, a bit of laziness, but also she doesn't want to have to lean on Rem, have her like clean up after her stuff. Yeah, so she sort of acknowledges her shortcomings as a maid compared to her sister, and is trying to like offload as much work onto Subaru as she can here.
And it's interesting as well that in the first loop, she didn't do this. Like, obviously, we've established that things have changed a little bit because of a few small tweaks in Subaru's behavior or his nature. But it's surprising that things have changed so much that this is happening. She's had this thought, like, I should teach him to read and write, and she's actually doing it.
Yeah.
It almost feels like there's something else afoot, doesn't it? In terms of...
I definitely got that feeling throughout this episode.
Mm, yeah, same.
It's hard to like put it down to just like the butterfly effect or something, or like or perhaps I don't know. Rem noticed something that's made Subaru appear vulnerable, or perhaps this is her way at like getting back at him for making fun of Rem for helping Roswell put on his thong. I don't know. And it's funny that she has like zero qualms about like putting him to work like that and then falling asleep right afterwards. That's pretty good. The next day, Subaru is with Rem trying out his new uniform. He laments that the twins don't have any cute outfits besides their maid uniforms. Rem sees them as a logical necessity. Besides, who would be happy to see her dress up?
She doesn't consider what she's wearing being dressed up. It's just a totally normal maid outfit. Completely normal.
You get a tiny glimpse of the, like, I guess the politics of the creators here as well. Like, it's Subaru seems like it's entirely logical that women should, like, dress up for, like, other people's like enjoyment.
Perhaps not the politics of the creators directly, but definitely the politics of Subaru come through here. Like he seems to think that it is a duty of women to like dress up nice for other people. I think he uses a line similar to that.
Yeah, what a pig.
Yeah, it's like if you dress up nice, it'll make me happy and increase my productivity.
and good grief.
Rem has a very like creepy, very ominous line here as well, where she says something like, "Would any good come of making you happy? I wonder."
I mean, it's a reasonable question to ask.
It's a quality burn, most definitely, but also like it seems to it perhaps cuts a little too deep, right? Like for a dumb remark like that Subaru makes. Like,
is this also the moment where they talk about how it's practical them having their maid's outfits because no one questions it?
Yeah, exactly. Like she makes a very clear point of like these maid outfits like establish a hierarchy and shows people what our relationship to Roswell is and the manner. She uses the word hierarchy. And that's when people use that word, they use it like in a very conscious kind of way. It's not the kind of thing you drop into casual conversation.
Yeah.
She also say that it means that like they can, it gives them like a freedom to like go where they need to.
Say something like that, right?
Yeah. It's like with that, like the spy conversation that was had in the previous episode, definitely feels big old hints here of that they're not just mates. Like,
they're definitely not just mates.
it is
a bit of a free pass to like to get to places where others usually aren't. That is true, if the Hitman series has taught us anything. She gets visibly miffed and walks off when Subaru suggests Rem should differentiate herself a little from her sister. We're treated to another montage of Subaru and the twins doing household chores. This time, however, we notice just how much of the burden falls on Rem, thanks to Ram's shoddy work. Ram notices that Rem keeps looking over at Subaru, suggesting that she is unhappy with his shit haircut. She kind of gets Rem to admit to her annoyance at Subaru. All the while, Beatrice looks on from a window in the mansion.
Do you think it's true that the reason she's looking at him is because of his haircut.
Interesting. I'm not sure. Like, you have this a hint at it, right, with the how Rem redoes all the like bushes that they're cutting. That made me feel like it was more sincere.
I don't know. I was just wondering if, like, you know, if you were one of them, regardless of how you felt about him, he might be something of an object of fascination in some way, especially if we consider the possibility that there's something odd going on at this mansion and with these individuals. I don't know. I just wondered if, like, there might be some other reason they're looking at him, or she's looking at him.
Yeah, I think that's totally legit. Like, I can believe it.
Yeah, I don't think that's an unreasonable conclusion, although, like, the way that they edit the scene is, like, really clever, like, how Rem, like, trimming the hedges, like, somehow leaves them more of a mess than they were before. And Rem sort of steps in to be the organizing influence, the neat and tidy, somewhat compulsive older sibling, younger sibling, I don't know. So, yeah, perhaps she would have, like, that same need to reorder, like, Subaru's shit haircut, right? But there is also something odd in the way that Rem and Ram interact in this moment, where Ram sort of has to tell, is this the right way around? Where Ram sort of has to tell Rem, it's because of his haircut, isn't it? That's why you're looking at him, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's only after, like, a little beat that Rem is like, oh, yes, your haircut, it's annoying. And she makes it sound genuine, too. It might very well be. But might also be something else.
Yeah, definitely seems like something else, doesn't it? You've convinced me fully.
Yeah, but it's done so subtly, and it's done so cleverly. It's like it's hidden there, waiting to be unearthed by podcasters with too much time on their hands.
It's interesting, too, that you bring attention to Beatrice looking on in the window. I don't think, like, I might have noticed this one, but, like, there was a time, maybe the previous episode, where Beatrice was looking out from the window again, like that you, like, mentioned as well.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think I'd noticed that, like, she's always there, like, staring out at them, like, interested. Like,
it's yeah.
An interesting, like, contradiction to the way she behaves when they're in person.
Right.
But then maybe also mirrors their the idea that she's, like, trapped in the house or, like, locked in. Like,
oh yeah, you know, oh, that's a whole nother thing. Damn. Yeah,
we got that. I thought we'd been told that by this point.
Yeah, it's like we haven't seen Beatrice step out of the confines of the mansion, have we? We do, like, each time we see Beatrice, it's behind, like, a large window and, like, with the crisscrossing window panes. It's sort of like a bit of a framed as being in a bit of a cage, right? Like, never impressive use of mise-en-scene. A mise en scène. That's a type of soup for those. Later that day, as Subaru is scrubbing the bath, Rem drops in to very formally apologize for her comments earlier in the day. It's not clear what she's apologizing for exactly. Subaru decides to take advantage of her politeness, saying he will accept her apology on the condition that she style his hair. Rem says some uncharitable things to Subaru that mirror Emilia's sentiments about him, but they agree to do his hair after Subaru's date with Emilia.
Why not before? Get his hair done for the date?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Whatever.
That's how I would do it. Yeah, I think the scene is also very strongly laden with a subtext that we're not sure what it is pointing to just yet. Rem sort of presents herself as this a very, very proper and formal and polite way. She believes she has to apologize for something that probably didn't require apologizing for. And I had some ideas about what it was for, but like they're not ever clear what she's apologizing for, I feel like. Do you all have an idea of what she might be apologizing for?
No, I didn't think it was clear.
Yeah, it felt to me it was just like her like behavior earlier and feeling like awkward about it, even though there wasn't really anything to apologize about. It's
like
maybe it was a misread on my part, but it felt a bit like a broken etiquette or like politeness somehow, and apologizing for
that. I think I felt the same way about it. But I think what's more interesting about this scene is what it tells us about Subaru, rather than being like, oh, what? That was not a big deal at all, which it wasn't. Rather than being like, oh, yeah, no, that's fine. I accept your apology. No harm done. He's like, he sort of like twists it to his advantage. And he's like, on one condition. Which it's harmless enough. He's just asking for a haircut here. He's just being a little bit cheeky, but like you could have done that differently, like without establishing like a sort of a uneven dynamic suddenly.
I thought he was being kind by doing the haircut.
Ah,
like, yeah, or like trying to make her feel less bad, or.
Mm.
Well, I suppose the fact that she's apologizing does make it seem as though she feels that she has done something wrong, and he's trying to relieve her of that burden, maybe, by saying, "Oh, it's fine. I do need a haircut, actually."
Yeah, no, that is also like a very valid read. Actually, I think I might be too harsh on Subaru at times. I don't know. No, none of these anime boys are catching a break from me. I'm like.
Mm.
The next day, Subaru is at the village he mentioned in the previous loop, doing some groceries with Rem. He's being bothered by a pack of village kids. Once Rem is done shopping, they walk back to the mansion by the light of the setting sun.
These village kids I thought was interesting. It's a tiny glimpse of what I assume is Subaru getting more skilled through having done a loop. Because like the way he previously describes them is he like that they were much more like troublesome and meddling, whereas this time he's like being like friendly and kind and like playing with them. Like,
well, we don't see them the first time around either, do we? We just have to take Subaru's word.
Yeah, maybe Subaru was still the same with them previously, but yeah, it implies that he's kind of got them on side this time somehow. Like,
leveled up his tact, his child wrangling. Plus two. They talk a little bit about everything and nothing, the hidden hierarchy observed by children, Subaru's studies, and Ram's self-assurance. Subaru likens Ram's faith in her sister to demonic possession. Do you like demons? Ram suddenly asks. Well, gods don't do anything, but demons will laugh along when you talk about future plans. Subaru replies. I absolutely love this scene. It's it's the strongest scene in these three episodes that did not involve Elsa. It's kind of like the culmination of like all of the work that has gone into the previous episode and in this one so far in like lulling you into a false sense of safety. Like they've switched gears from action thriller to slice of life, but this is no ordinary slice of life, and this is no ordinary conversation. It's paced and it moves along at such a pace that it like tries to convince you that this is just two people getting to know each other better, but perhaps this is two people coming to understand just how little they know about each other. This exchange about demons and gods seems like full of significance, but it also, like, on a base level, on the surface, just establishes these characters and the way that they think so well. Like, why does Ram ask, like, entirely unprompted about Subaru's feelings about demons?
It's a funny moment, isn't it? Yeah. Like, totally not a demon, but do you like demons?
Like... Is it because he said that her faith in her sister is, like, demonic possession?
I think that's, like...
Do you like demons?
Yeah. It opens up the, like, the ability to ask the question, but it's, like, it's not the reason why she's asking it. Like...
Yeah.
It totally felt to me as, like, this was just... It felt almost a bit too, like, blatant of, like, by the way, me and Nolan Ram are demons.
Like... I didn't like the scene as much as you. I think I struggled with the pacing. Oh, maybe we'll talk about that more broadly in the closing thoughts, but, like, this was one of the scenes that contributed to my, like, struggle with the pacing. Thing. Like, I didn't really get anything out of this. I thought one of the useful things that it did was to further solidify that line between Rem and Ram as two distinct personalities that have their own thoughts and feelings, and that was important. But I didn't find the conversation they were having, like, very compelling, or maybe that's not the right word. I was like, please come and get to the next scene.
Yeah.
I was like, I guess I wasn't, like, interested enough in getting to know either of them, I think, yet. I mean, I'm sure there's, like, interesting stuff to come with these characters, but at this point I was kind of like, I don't find either of them that interesting. So, like, watching a conversation between the two of them that was, like, very slow and full of, I think, again, full of probably subtext. I found, like, harder to get excited about.
Yeah, no, I get that. Mm-hmm.
It's just that these three episodes are quite slow in the mansion. Mm. It's like a slower pace of life to what we had in the sort of loot house arc, where there's lots of excitement and, like, a sort of a tension and a ticking clock, it felt like. Like, something to work towards and something to race against. And this is, like, way slowed down. And there's nothing wrong with that. I was, like, waiting for the next thing to happen, you know?
Absolutely. No, I feel that 100%. And I don't think you're wrong at all, because I think the first time I watched it, I felt a similar way. And it's just... making me reconsider just how I should be talking about this series, because at the moment I'm just, like, just being a jerk and being like, I know stuff.
Yeah, I bet. But that's why I think, you know, like, there probably is interesting stuff to come with these guys. So, like, I'm sure that's, like, that plays a big part in, like, how you feel about it. And I'm sure, like, if I were to watch it again after seeing the whole thing, it would change how I felt about it too. So, yeah, it's interesting to hear you talk about it.
But rest assured, I do know stuff.
The bit where, Rem, like, smiles and is, like, super happy as well in the response. Like, my memory could be flawed there, but I really thought there was another one of those, like, cherry blossom moments with that felt to me. Right. It's like, it was almost like a Zelda, like, opening a chest moment. Like, he's had a character unlock with Amelia, and now he's just had one with Rem as well.
Like, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. There is another a moment of, like, a startling realization that Subaru has. And it's attached to, like, these female characters, these beauties that he's drawn to.
I'm just hoping the next little arc is not with there and Betty. I want it to move on. Betty's away.
Rem and Subaru have that exchange, and this causes Rem to smile genuinely, much to Subaru's delight. That evening, Amelia joins Subaru in his room to help him study. Subaru can't help but freak out at their proximity.
Yeah, he can barely hold it together. It's like he's never seen a girl before.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, what is so different about this situation than the previous ones that you were in with of this person? Well, I guess it's like nighttime and your room, but like, get it together, man.
Yeah.
This is why you nut before you go on dates. That's my advice to all the fellas listening. I'm gonna nut.
To avoid sitting there at your desk looking like this.
Anime dating tips, baby. He manages to suppress his anxiety for a second and asks Amelia on a date again. He jumps through a whole lot of loops to... whole lot of hoops to get her as well. Like, he's just Subaru at his most awkward. He looks up at the ceiling and he says, "Suki ga kire desu ne."
Yeah, he does, doesn't he? Yeah.
Are y'all familiar with the origin of that phrase, actually?
No.
Suki ga kire desu ne?
Yeah.
No.
It's super interesting because it's something that is like pointed to as it's an example of like translation versus localization. When people talk about like translating whatever anime books, visual novels, whatever, talk about like translating a phrase versus localizing a phrase, and like apocryphally. This phrase, suki ga kire desu ne, a Japanese author and like sort of like a writing tutor, I think it was in like late 19th century, sort of he offered a class on like English translation, right? Mm-hmm. And apparently one of his students like translated the phrase "I love you" in a literal way, which would be something like kimi o aisu or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then the tutor, I forget his name, where he said something like, "Well, no Japanese person would ever say that. You should translate this as suki ga kire desu ne."
Wow.
Yeah.
And what does it translate? Yeah, so, like, what's the literal translation of that?
Oh. Yeah, so the moon is beautiful. Yeah, the moon is pretty, isn't it? Yeah, and to this day, it's sort of like a phrase that is like used in Japanese in a sort of a poetic way. If you're being a love struck cornball or whatever, you'd use this a phrase like a "suki ga kire desu ne."
Cool, that's really interesting. I didn't know that. Mm.
Right? Yeah, it's a dope little tidbit for you.
It just makes me think of that scene in Terrace House where I can't remember either of their names, but they're on a date and the guy goes, Desha? Yeah. Like the train. Like,
oh, Densha.
Densha. Densha. Yeah. Mm. Densha.
And then and later on, there, because the train's really loud next to them. And then there's another scene later on, the same couple are on a date and a really loud plane goes overhead and he says, "Hikoki."
The exact same poetic nature of the moon. Yeah.
Wow. That is some powerful energy right there. I gotta like that. Take notes. Yeah, so he asks Amelia on a date again. She accepts after some insistence, then leaves, telling him to work hard. Their dates will be his rewards. Yeah, and then there's a post-credits sequence.
Yeah, why was this a post-credit sequence? Mm, it was like kind of key to the episode, key to the story. Like, if you weren't looking for post-credit stuff, you'd miss it, right?
Yeah, you absolutely would, because they play like the ending theme in its entirety, before like these post-credit bits come up.
Me and Vicky almost missed this. Yeah.
Boy, you're telling me you don't listen to the ending theme all the way through each time? The shit slaps. Post-credits, we see Subaru sat at a little table, struggling to keep himself awake. He is determined to see the sun rise on the promised morning. Slowly, his eyes start fluttering shut, but just as they do, he is struck by a sudden and intense nausea.
Just before the nausea, watching the moment where he's there like, okay, I'm just not going to sleep this whole night. All I could think was, it's like, what an idiot he's being. It's like, you're going to be so tired on your, like, day. It's like, I really thought that was going to be the funny part about the post-credit scene. Was the, he's just, like, knackered and exhausted for his date. Yeah.
Bags under his eyes.
That would be an altogether more pleasant outcome than what happens next.
Yeah.
Oh man, it's this it gets intense. It gets real graphic, real visceral. The room spins and he froze up violently. He makes it out of his room to search for help, but he's hardly strong enough to move and puking every step of the way. As he shakily walks into another hallway, he hears a shrill scraping sound. He's suddenly blown back with a force so violent he is lifted off of his feet. He looks up to see that his arm has been ripped from his body. He writhes in pain when suddenly the scraping resumes and his head is exploded.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah, they spare no expense in like showing us the fucking agony that Subaru goes through in this sequence. It's chilling.
Yeah, it's really pretty horrifying and a really great another great example of what we talked about in our previous episode of the way one of the things I think this show does really well is tonal shifting without giving you like total whiplash. I don't know how they do it, but like the sudden change in feeling is really good and really works.
Just thinking back to what you were saying about the scene with Subaru and Rem's little walk, perhaps it's a little to do with like attrition, in a sense, like. This anime has shown us in the first two episodes like a really exciting and strong concept that could lead to lots of dramatic like action and tension, and episode three is sort of like a making good on that promise, and then suddenly we're like given two episodes of like a slice of life and new characters behaving oddly, behaving illogically, and this sudden switch up of the rules of Subaru's gift / curse, and this is sort of the rewards in a sense, and I guess in that sense it is not as odd as a post-credit sequence, like perhaps not something that I would have done, but like this is your reward, just like a couple minutes of like intense violence and Subaru making the most horrified faces and then you're like okay we're back in it. Fuck
yeah, I like it. I'm ready to see what all this is about. I it makes you really wonder about like the previous reset, you know, obviously something horrific's going on in the mansion that night, but like is the reason he doesn't remember dying previously because he died in his sleep? Like, was he poisoned? I don't know.
Yeah, it's the nausea's a really great part of that, isn't it? That like kind of hints towards him being like poisoned by someone. And it's like, well, it's Rem and Ram making the food at the moment, so what's that's going true, on there? Yeah.
That's a reasonable conclusion, right? Like this time he managed to make it through the poisoning rather than dying in his sleep, and then someone or something decided to finish the job in a more personal way.
There's also potentially like it feels like there's like multiple possible readings to it, and that's nice. Like, there's like different things you can guess at. Stuff like the nausea is like that could just be something specific about this time period rather than anything to do with him actually getting killed. Like,
yeah, I suppose so.
Yeah.
We've had two arcs so far. Well, I guess this arc isn't quite done yet, but we're seeing two distinct arcs, and this appears to be a little bit of a turning point into something else. And so, I'm hyped to watch the next tree.
Yeah, me too.
Especially now that we've seen that he dies here, like,
yeah, brutally.
Yeah, that makes it way more interesting as to what's going on here and what the time loop is actually happening around.
And what was it that killed him when he walked in the hallway?
Love a mystery. Let's do one more Seiyu segment and get into our closing thoughts, shall we?
Yes.
All right, so I've got the voice of Ram, which is Murakawa Rie. And I didn't recognize many of her credits, sadly, except for two. But I think it's significant to point out that that Ram has a voice actor that does not voice Ram also. That's two different voice actors.
I definitely thought they were the same voice actor.
And they do a similar kind of affectation. They do, like, they have a similar a manner of speaking, but they're two different voices. So this is also the voice of Anzu in Hina Matsuri, a hilarious anime about a psychic girl who gets sent to the past to live with a yakuza.
And this is cool.
And this is also the voice of Bubble Girl in My Hero Academia. Do y'all remember Bubble Girl? Because I don't.
I feel like I can picture her, but I can't remember who she is.
Does she work for the agency that the girls' agency that do shampoo brands and stuff?
Is she at the camp that they go away to or whatever? Like,
Maybe I'm misthinking.
I can picture her, but I can't remember where she goes.
I don't remember either, but there you go. Just an anime full of great characters, but you can't remember all of their names.
Yeah.
All right, so that was episode 3. We just discussed 3 real solid episodes. I was gonna say action packed, but I think that only really counts for one of the 3. Let's move into our thoughts, feelings, and perhaps even our predictions for what's to come, or like what we'd like to see. I'm gonna start with you, Sam, if you don't mind.
Sure. So I think overall, this post-credit scene for episode 5 was super important in terms of, like, I'm interested to see what happens next. Like, my interest was waning really quickly as the episodes were going on. And I think part of that is an overall feeling I have towards the show, which is the promise of a time loop anime I was so excited by, but it doesn't deliver at all on the expected narrative of a time loop anime, and a time loop piece of media. It's hardly doing anything with the time loops, which I feel really disappointed by as a viewer. It's my expectations were there that I was going to get something, and it's not giving me that. So I'm finding it hard to get over that, even though it does have stuff that's interesting, and it's got all this promise of future stuff you will get, but it's hasn't really given me any of that yet, and it hasn't really given me any of the cool time loop figuring things out.
Yeah.
And I also don't like the way it's paced. I think it would what we've seen so far could have been done in half as many episodes and still been impactful. But I do want to see where it's going. I do like that there is still time loop stuff going on, and you'll get to see that puzzle unfold. And I do they're a classic fantasy-esque universe with magic systems and stuff that hopefully Subaru will get all caught up in, and you'll get to see loads of cool stuff there. And maybe there'll be some more interesting twists and developments. It could easily end up being quite generic, but I'm hopeful that it won't be. But I also wouldn't be surprised if it ended up just being pretty generic.
You're along for the ride, though.
Yeah, I'm along for the ride. And I think, yeah, it's about changing my expectations, I think. It's like, after watching like the first like bit where he dies like straight away in episode one, I was like, sweet, I'm into this. And then it's like, no way, we sold you on that, but that's not at all what you're watching. Like,
you were saying during our discussion of episode three, you thought that Subaru was going to get sent back to the loot house.
Yeah.
He was going to have to go through that thing all over again, and like in sort of like a more Groundhog Day-esque fashion, right?
Exactly that, yeah. It's Groundhog Day is what I was looking for. Like,
yeah. Wait, you wanted that?
Yeah, I wanted that.
You think you would have been more satisfied with that than what we've had so far?
If they'd have done it how I wanted them to, yeah. But also, I think had they have done what they have done, but just faster, I would be pretty happy with it so far. I think it's
okay.
Yeah, I think it's lots of the it's, I guess, like, I want to say like the pros. It's like everything just feels like way too wordy in a way that doesn't give me any character building. Like, it just feels like it's there because they like the way the sentence sounds. They like they fit together rather than anything that the like characters would actually have, or like any it just feels like it's, everything's just a bit long, like in a way that I'm struggling to enjoy as much. Like,
yeah,
like a cutting critique.
We've observed the same thing in our last episode as well. It is definitely like a bit talky, and so some might interpret that as being like a tad pretentious. Like, do these anime characters, do these waifu bait characters really have all that much to say? And who knows? At this, must shrug my shoulders.
It's like, it's totally reassuring knowing that you know stuff is coming. So there's something extra to look forward to through that. Like, that's definitely given me like more faith in it. But, like, without having that, it's like, it really does feel like pretty shallow so far. Like, I think, well, not shallow. Like, it's better than that. I've seen way worse. But like.
Just be glad you weren't here for high school prodigies. Oh,
yeah. It's definitely better than that.
Yeah, I think Vicky said a really good thing about it, in that like how obvious the like statement of like show don't tell is, that like people always use in like writing or like any kind of storytelling, but like this just doesn't listen to that. It's just telling you stuff about the world the whole time. It's not showing you anything. Like,
yeah. Well, I guess that was one of the things I said after we watched it. It was like something that Steins Gate does really well. I can't help but compare this to Steins Gate. Is it does have a lot of talking and a fairly slow pace and elements of slice of life. For me, the reason that really works is that the characters really show you who they are through their actions and little bits of banter and their dynamics with each other, which are presented really neatly and endearingly. And I felt a lot of ReZero so far has been characters just constantly like telling you who they are through their like describing themselves and describing each other. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, maybe it's like a preference thing. I don't know.
No, I think that's I think that's entirely warranted. And the comparison to Steins Gate is like a valid comparison as well. Like they're sort of met with the same challenges, and like this is a different story with a different approach. I think it's they sort of exist in comparison with each other, and it's useful as a touchstone.
Absolutely.
I mean, as for things I'd like to see moving forwards, I'd like to see him get killed a bunch more. Like, trying to figure this out.
I
want to
see him die.
I don't want to see him go through another slow loop, where my assumption will be it'll be a slow loop talking to Betty that will end in them somehow escaping it, because he doesn't seem to go through the loops very often. But yeah, what I would like is for him to figure things out by getting killed a bunch.
Yeah, I hear you. I think that was like definitely a hook for me when I first watched the series. It's like, what? The OP dies a bunch of times? That sounds great. Like, you know, after coming off of the umpteenth series about an OP guy who never gives up and never loses hope. Yes, I would like to see the main character's skull being crushed and his eyeball rolling away.
Like, hell yeah,
that sounds great. any other comments you want to leave us with, Sam?
I'm not sure. I think, yeah, I'm ready to become more invested in it. I think mm-hmm. I think I would totally hoping that like there's some interesting twists coming or something, like some fulfillment on some of these like promises that are gonna be like, oh, this is getting really good. Like,
hell yeah.
Oh,
you got plenty of episodes to go.
A few episodes in, yeah.
Yeah. All right, Vicky, how about yourself? What's what are your big takeaways from these episodes? What would you like to see?
Yeah, well, I already said a little bit while Sam was talking, mm-hmm. Just my feelings about like how it does character, mm-hmm. which it's like, yeah, I think maybe it's the it's a combination of not being able to help myself comparing it to Steins Gate and the fact that I'm not like a huge fan of how wordy it is. That are making me feel a little bit like I wish the character development was a bit different. I do feel excited after the end of that last episode, or rather like after the post-credits sequence, the end of that episode. I think that one of the strengths of the show is like it does do a good job of cultivating an atmosphere of something really isn't right in this place, at least in these episodes. You know, like in this house you get the feeling something really weird is going on. And that's kind of the hook for me. I'm not averse to slice of life stuff at all. Like, I didn't necessarily enjoy the slice of life stuff that was going on here.
Mm-hmm.
The show is almost like a give with one hand and take with the other sometimes, because it's it's like slowing down the pacing massively, and then suddenly it hits you with these moments that are sort of like really like spread out. Like, you know, him waking up at the end of episode 3, is it episode 3 or whichever episode it is, episode 4, and the loop has started again. That's exciting and it's cool. And then the very end of episode 5, he's been killed. That's really cool. I'm not saying that the show needs to kill him a bunch of times to make it exciting or anything, but I just wish there was like a little bit more excitement.
Just a little bit more killing
going on. Like, I get what they're doing. I think I understand why they're doing it. It's like setting itself up to be a character driven, like a semi, I don't want to call it a slow burner, but like a character driven exploration of like time loop set in medieval fantasy style world. And I think, you know, if that's its aim, it's doing that. I do like Subaru as a character. I find him like he's like, you know, semi generic in a lot of ways, like as a anime protagonist, but I do find him kind of charming. Although I don't like, one of the things I thought was really weird in the last episode we watched was he's trying to do that same day over again so he can get that date with Amelia, but he kept referring to it as a promise, like keeping a promise to Amelia, or keeping a promise with Amelia. When, you know, for her, no such thing has happened, and he doesn't really need to keep any promises to her. He doesn't have any obligation to her. Yeah. Sorry, I went off on a bit of a tangent there.
That was an excellent point.
But I kind of echo what Sam says about like the little promises in this show. I bet when they get fulfilled. And we've already seen when they are fulfilled, it's fucking exciting. And the show does such a good job in those scenes of making you feel uneasy and making you feel like kind of horrified and gripped and excited for the next bit. So yeah, that's because those moments are so gripping. You're like, I want more of that. It's not that I want more killing. I just think the show does those moments so well. I want more of that feeling. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I hear that.
Yeah, but you know, there are things to like. I think the show is pretty funny, and they are building an interesting world. The world building is good, and very natural. I think there's not horrible exposition dumps or anything like that. The information is fed to you quite nicely in a satisfying way, like taking sips of a warm soup.
Hell yeah. Yeah, they sure do talk a lot, but at least they've avoided the pitfall of like needless exposition like some other animes.
Yeah, exactly.
Like some animes, so yeah, we know.
It's like some we have maybe seen before this one. But yeah, the next bit, I'm excited to see what happens. I think if the first couple of episodes were establishing a pattern for how this loop's going to work, I wonder if this is going to follow that same pattern, if he's going to wake up again tomorrow during the same day again, and if he will be able to prevent his own horrible demise and then move on to the next save point. I think that'd be really cool. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Yes, so am I.
So I've got just a couple of comments really. I just want to like commend this anime so far for being like as confident as it is, as like as daring in like the way it like switches from one extreme tone to another, like one extreme like genre shift to another. It can be possibly jarring to some, but like I find it like cool and punk rock. This is a punk rock anime.
It is definitely bold. That change in pacing is bold, yeah.
Right. Yeah, we just we've lost a handful of characters like Felt, Rom, Elsa, Reinhardt, just gone for the time being, and it brings in just a whole never host, a whole never cast, and I feel that the world is expanded by this. It's enriched by it and made more colorful. I find the way that it executes the time loop story to be really impressive, and like we've only like scratched the surface of like how this operates as a show and like as part of like the in-world lore or whatever, but it's already managed to like bring up questions for us about like causality and our actions and their consequences, the butterfly effect, and the ways in which people are more changeable, more fickle than you may know, and like and the ways in which people like hide who they are, and presents a kind of front for the world for you to see. This episode is kind of marked by these kind of characters, these characters who present themselves as one thing but maybe another. You know, Emilia suddenly revealed to be a royalty, perhaps. Rem and Ram are like supposedly these Moe Bates, like maids who are like playing this game of like which twin is which, but there's something else bubbling beneath the surface.
Even with Emilia saying that she was Santella to start off with.
Yeah, absolutely. This is like the second game that she is playing, or is she playing a game? Who knows? Like there's something going on. Rosewell presents himself as being a gay clown, but he is in fact a lordly clown. where did the lies end and the truth begin? I'm curious to see. And finally, just gotta shout out these episodes. Where episode 3 was really visually impressive, and it's like a fight animation and choreography, like Reinhardt's doing his ults, fucking pops, Elsa, spider running everywhere. It's just a what a sight. But the next two episodes are a lot more subdued, and it's the focus is a bit more on background animation and setting a particular seed, setting a mood, setting a tone, as you pointed out, and it's so competent. It's like it's hyper competent. It's some real show off type shit. But the soundtrack, I think, pops especially, and I really love the little choral sting when Subaru realizes something is off, and like
I love that.
just very cool. That's my thoughts there.
Nice.
Anything else that you might have remembered that you wanted to bring up?
Well, just I could see something in your notes, Lawrence, about like Subaru's the idea of him playing a video game while he's here. I think we talked about this a little bit, Sam, how like it kind of reminds me of when we watched Hamafura and like I've forgotten her name. Katarina.
Katarina,
Yeah, how like is everyone around her just an NPC to her, and she's like trying to beat the Doom flags? Is that what's going on for Subaru a little bit? Like, are these, does he see these people as characters in a video game, like as the maid characters, the cute female character? He obviously feels like he's got something he needs to be doing here, or something he's like working towards here. Like he's playing a game. He references video game mechanics frequently. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah, like when is Subaru gonna start taking this seriously? When is he gonna see these people as people, if they are people? We'll see.
Yeah.
All right, shall we close it out then?
Hell yeah.
Cool. So I'm gonna drop in some plugs real quick, but before that, thank you so much to Sam for guesting on the podcast with
thank
us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Sam.
It's a pleasure. And I'm thinking since y'all are like watching the show together anyway, like if you feel like there's an episode that comes up and you really need to get some shit off of your chest, you just just come on by, put on the headphones, and again, let's break this down.
Yeah, it's been great. I've enjoyed it.
Hell yeah!
Nice.
All right, so just a couple of plugs for our listeners. As per usual, our Twitter can be found at reincarnatedpods. Check it out. I put up some screenshots of the episodes, and I make sure to pick some funny ones. Give us a follow. You can also send us an email if you like, and we can get into some real isekai chats. You can email us at reincarnated.podcasters@gmail.com. I'm going to throw in another plug for my Substack, because I've been updating again. I recently wrote a little post about the Ursula Le Guin book I keep mentioning, Fishermen of the Inland Sea, and how one of its stories relates to Gundam, and how I wish Ursula Le Guin could have written a Gundam series. I think that would absolutely slap and would definitely work based on the stories that she writes there. Yeah, so my Substack, dldarscrolls.substack.com. That's dldarscrolls.substack.com. So next time on Reincarnated as Podcasters, we discuss episodes 6 to 8 of ReZero. We hope you enjoyed listening. See you in the next life.
See you.
Goodbye. I'm not afraid of the dark.
Off this don't let me.